This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. This story is from our episode about navigating healthcare. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Mimi Hayes is a comedian and writer. She was in her early 20s when she started having some very strange symptoms. And everywhere she turned, she was told it was anxiety, exhaustion, or really nothing. She was ready to give up, but her mom wasn't having it.
I went on a blind date. Okay, Cupid, I think. He was your typical finance bro. Crew cut, one of those fleece vests. We ordered appetizers. My head was throbbing like crazy. All I could think about was getting through this and getting home. My mom picked me up after because my car had broken down that week. Mom and I are kind of partners in crime. Speaking of crime, we watch a lot of Forensic Files late at night together. She falls asleep at the sound of incriminating evidence.
Well, she had been out on a date, but she was so disheveled. She was tired, she was cranky, she didn't look good at all, and she had a horrible, horrible headache. I mean, like, bad, bad headache. And so I remember taking her home. You know, I think we gave her some aspirin, but she was sick.
I was 22 at the time, living with my mom in Aurora, Colorado, just about to start my first job as a high school teacher.
I just kind of brushed it off as, oh, well, she's doing it again. She's just not taking care of herself, and she's going in 5,000 directions, which has been an issue with Mimi since day one.
But then things got worse. About a week in, I got sick on my way to school and had to pull over on the side of the road to throw up. Mom took me to urgent care that day.
They said, oh, it's vertigo. And so they said, just get some over-the-counter
Dramamine. You know, that stuff you take when you're carsick? Well, I took that, and that's not helping. Next up is my primary care doctor. Mom came along to that appointment, too. There they said that it had something to do with fluid in my ears. I needed to see a specialist. Mom got crafty.
Because that's what the doctor's saying, is the ears. And we can't get into a specialist, so I'm going to fix this myself.
Here we go. So Mom decided to get me on the family inversion table and had my older sister flip me upside down for about 10 minutes to get the supposedly blocked fluid out of my ears.
It was the weirdest feeling. It was like all of my guts felt like they were like in my head.
Mm-hmm.
Like not in a normal way.
I got so terribly sick after that first flip, I can't even tell you. I couldn't move my head without puking. My sister rushed me to the nearest ER. I felt like my stomach was in my head. They didn't have any answers. As far as they were concerned, I was dehydrated. A nurse missed my vein, an entire bag of IV fluid leaked into my lap, and she accused me of pissing myself.
But then in comes this other doctor, and he was a neurologist. And he literally did this, you know, follow my fingers things, and you're saying, There's two fingers. And then he walked away, and that was all he did.
He had only been holding up one finger. Apparently that neurologist didn't see my double vision as too concerning. I went home in paper pants. And the next morning, Mom made me call my doctor and tell her what had happened. But I kept getting a nurse, and she told me just to get some rest.
You just need to rest, is what she said. And then I called you back.
In tears, yeah.
And I said, well, I guess this is my life now. I guess I just need to sleep this off.
At this point, she snapped.
I came home and
it felt like within seconds you burst through the door.
Yeah, I literally did. I was like, I'm out of here. And
Mom is not the type to roll over. Picture Queen Khaleesi in Game of Thrones when she goes all fire and brimstone. She left work and took me back to the ER. This time at a different hospital.
I just remember just a very quick, brief triage questions about, you know, am I bleeding? Like, it just felt like I didn't deserve to be there because
right.
I didn't know what was going on.
Well,
and I honestly kind of thought you were overreacting.
I was like,
oh God, she's going to cause a scene.
I did cause a scene.
And you did.
I immediately informed them that I'd already talked to my attorney and that we weren't leaving until they figured out what was wrong with you. And so I was lying through my teeth.
There's no attorney.
Oh, of course not. But that's how frustrated I was.
Finally, we got in to see a nurse. And she did that same neuro test, holding her finger in front of my eyes. Except she was doing it wrong. She wasn't moving her finger.
And at that point, I just lost my cookies. And I literally leaped out of my chair and I said, no. And I had seen the neurologist the day before do the neurological exam with his finger, because I just seen that. And so I go, no. And also, I'm a psychologist. I knew a little bit about brains. So I go, no, it's like this. And I did the exam. And she goes, right there. I go, it's over here. You know, and so I did the exam. I literally pushed the lady out of the way. That's how crazy I was.
When my mom did the neuro test, my eyes were all over the place, wiggling and not able to follow her finger. They finally agreed to give me an MRI. The scan revealed a circular blood spot on my brain, a rupture of clump of cells called a cavernous angioma, sitting in my cerebellum on the right side. They said the words hemorrhagic stroke for the first time. And then the nurse quickly left the room, and I had a panic attack. Was I about to die right now on this little metal table? How long can you live with a bleed in your brain anyway? My bleed was contained inside that clump of cells, at least for the time being. The clump had perhaps been there since I was born, and now it had filled with blood. They sent me home with some steroids and told me to check in a few weeks. It didn't get better. I got worse. The brain bleed continued to grow. Eventually, I was unable to walk or see straight. I needed brain surgery to remove the bleeding clump of cells, and then months of rehab to relearn how to walk, talk, and do third grade math problems. My mom saved my life that day. But what if she hadn't been there? What if they didn't catch it at all? I could have ended up permanently disabled. Or worse, I could have died. I couldn't help but feel angry. How come everybody but my mom dismissed my symptoms?
I think there's no doubt from what you've said that what you experienced would probably be classified as a medical mistake or a medical error. It's the kind of error we would call a diagnostic delay.
This is Matthew Winia over at the University of Colorado. He's the director of the Center of Bioethics and Humanities down at the Anschutz Medical Campus in my hometown of Aurora. He studies breakdowns in the healthcare system.
If you are dealing with a young person, the odds that they're going to be having a stroke compared to, you know, a 70 or an 80-year-old are really, really small. They're not zero, though, as you know, but they are quite small. And so the barrier to jumping straight to, you know, a CT scan or an MRI scan is considerably higher. It's mm-hmm. all sort of a balancing act of, you know, at what point do you pull the trigger and say, okay, we ought to get the MRI scan, knowing that 9 or 90 or 99 times out of 100, it's not going to show anything useful. And a few times out of 100, it might actually end up being harmful.
There's some interesting psychology on this, too. Matt called it premature closure, or the process of finding evidence to support your opinions and downgrading anything that might go against that.
You know, this is a young woman. She probably has a migraine. Okay, so now I'm just looking for things that confirm it's a migraine. And anything that disconfirms that, I'm going to downplay or downgrade in my mind.
And while approximately 795,000 people in the U.S. have strokes each year, 15% of those young adults and adolescents, they often don't have any of the typical symptoms.
So something that's been quite interesting to me is...
I talked about that with Amelia Baim, a neuroepidemiologist at Columbia University.
About 35% of people between the age of 18 and 35 who were admitted for a stroke did not have any stroke risk factors.
Wait, how much percent?
About 35%.
These are all the risk factors you usually have before you have a stroke.
Hypertension, diabetes, atrial fibrillation, obesity, and smoking.
Doctors use the acronym BFAST to identify traditional stroke symptoms. I only had the B, which is balance, and E, which is eyes. And we also know very little about the outcomes for young stroke victims, how they recover, and what their quality of life is. I also talked to Laura Stein, professor of emergency medicine at Mount Sinai.
You know, I can give you statistics about rates of recurrent stroke or rates of heart attack in young people who are hospitalized for these conditions, but I can't tell you anything about their self-report of quality of life after stroke, about really meaningful things like fatigue, depression, anxiety, ability to go back to every single thing they were doing. That's the kind of data that we really don't have, and that's the kind of stuff that's really meaningful to young people who have their entire lives to live with the experience that they've had.
I was really fortunate to have physical, occupational, and speech therapy right after my surgery. But I wanted to know, how were other survivors doing? And where were they? In an unlikely place, actually. Instagram. I have been posting pictures about my brain injury for Brain Injury Awareness Month. I was about 3 years post-stroke. I was living in New York City then, and fulfilling the typical starving artist stereotype as a stand-up comedian, a nanny, and like five other jobs I can't even remember. During March, I posted a picture of myself with noise-canceling headphones, because sound was bothering me on the New York City subways.
And you had your headphones on, and I just remember I broke down, and all I wanted to do was give you a hug, because I knew exactly what you were going through. I knew exactly what you were feeling.
This is Joe Borges. He's a podcaster and stroke survivor out in L.A. In 2016, he was in a parking lot when he had the worst headache of his life. He is still sensitive to sounds like I am.
I reached out because I saw somebody who was like me, and I needed to connect with somebody like me because I really felt alone. And it was the most isolating time in my life. And I had no idea, because brain injury, that you had this impact on my life, Mimi. This is awesome. Thank you, you tiny, amazing human being.
I love you, Joe.
It changed my life. It genuinely changed my life.
Joe and I have never met in person, yet we've laughed together, cried together, and given each other our most vulnerable selves. What started as a way to find people like him has led Joe on a mission to support and uplift survivors on their roads to recovery. Joe sends upwards of 30 messages a day to survivors on social media to give them hope, ask them about their struggles, and connect them with other survivors in their cities.
We're bonded by tragedy, but we've become like family by choice. You know, I want everybody to feel this because it's necessary. It's necessary to grow and move forward in recovery. You know, like even people who are 7, 8, 9, 10, 15, 20 years out, they still have room to grow in recovery. You know what I mean? This is where the focus should be.
Joe and I are lucky. We've recovered in ways that many don't. My recovery isn't over just yet. Maybe never will be. It's been 6 years and I still struggle with fatigue, brain fog, and double vision in the mornings. But it feels like a small price to pay. Maybe I'll even get to meet my best friend Joe in person someday.
And I can't believe I haven't met you. It's like that show Love is Blind.
Oh my God, you know what's hilarious? I'm actually a 5'3" Asian woman. This is what's crazy.
That was comedian Mimi Hayes telling us the story of having a brain hemorrhage at a young age.